Web.org. Tonight, Lake Geneva Badger plays Waukesha West in third-round playoff action. The winner advances to the state tournament. Kickoff is 7 p.m. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Friday, November the 13th. Partly sunny and, again, windy and brisk. Wind gusts up to 45 miles per hour today, high of 43. Sunny this morning, wind is out of the west at 15 miles per hour. Here are the new numbers just in, 41 degrees Racine, 38 Kenosha, 35 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We are exploring the world of the human brain today, and all that we think of in conjunction with study of the brain. And I have in hand a book called The Brain, An Illustrated History of Neuroscience. This is part of a very interesting series of books from Shelter Harbor Press called Ponderables, 100 Discoveries That Changed History, Who Did What When. And in this particular book, an especially fascinating entry in the series, we explore the way in which human beings have sought to understand themselves and what makes them human, and how humans very, very slowly came to a realization that the brain was an integral part of our own humanness. But of course, it took centuries for man to develop any kind of actual grasp of how the brain functions and exactly what it does. And of course, there are still mysteries that involve the brain that even in our modern age, we still do not completely understand. So when it comes to various scientific disciplines, there maybe isn't a discipline quite as fascinating as that of neuroscience. And the man who is seeking to unlock this rich and varied and intriguing history for us is none other than Tom Jackson, who is a highly regarded science writer who lives in the United Kingdom. And he specializes in taking scientific matters and in particular the historic view of various scientific disciplines and bringing it into the realm of the general public, where we can at least try to understand some of what has gone on. And I'm very, very happy that I can have this opportunity to speak with him about his book, which again is called The Brain, An Illustrated History of Neuroscience, published by Shelter Harbor Press. And Tom Jackson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I sure appreciate it. Where are you talking to me from this morning?
I'm based in Bristol in the west of England.
Very good. Well, it's great to be talking with you, and congratulations on a really superb book. As you undertook this assignment, at the outset, did you have a full understanding and appreciation of just how complex an assignment this was, of just how complex the history of neuroscience was?
it's the short answer. The longer one is that I didn't know how early it started, really, how early the history of our attempts to understand the brain go back. But it would appear that there were neurosurgeons or brain surgeons working 10,000 years ago, chiseling holes in people's skulls. There are many skulls that have been found with these holes in. They appear to, the owner of those skulls appear to survive the procedure. So we know that it wasn't a blow to the head that killed them. It was actually a deliberate hole being cut into their heads. So that's really the beginning of the story. What I wasn't really prepared for was how, as you said in your intro, how new the science was and how many more questions there still are to answer. I'm used to dealing with other specific narratives, things like chemistry and physics and biology and geology, these venerable old subjects that have been around for centuries and have had many, many famous names, discovering many famous whereas neuroscience is still very young. The surprising thing was how relatively recently people were still kind of working on hunches. They were still just had a, they were working towards, and there wasn't the solid grounding from earlier discoveries that they were that they could build from. And it's not until probably the 1960s that you get in, that neuroscience gets into the that realm where, along with the more established sciences, they're building a firm, solid foundations, discovery upon discovery.
Right. One of the things that's really intriguing as we read the earlier part of your book is how often there is somebody who will make an essentially correct assumption about the brain, and yet right alongside that core matter of whatever they have assumed to be true, which happens to be correct, they will make a plethora of other assumptions that in fact aren't correct at all. And this helps explain sort of the fits and starts of this growth of what we ultimately called neuroscience.
Well, that's right. Yeah, science is all in the same way. There's a thing called, they enter what's known as a crisis, where all the established theories cease to, the number of questions that the established theories can't answer, just get to a crisis point. There are so many unanswered questions that they have to basically assume that the theories are incorrect, and they have to come up with a new one, and they have this, you know, what's known as the paradigm shift, where discovery just turns up, or a new set of ideas arrives, normally from one source, that just rewrites the whole thing. Those paradigm shifts are very famous in other sciences. In neuroscience, they were still probably waiting for the next paradigm shift. It's trying to find the physical link between what's going on in the brain with the mental processes that make us human, and that really has so far proven to be quite a difficult task.
Right. It brings to mind one of the central points you make in the introduction to the book, which I think is worth our talking about, in which you talk about the staggering complexity of the human brain, and yet, on the other hand, its utter simplicity, that it is this incredibly complex system, and yet, as sort of a physical organ, astonishingly simple. And you tell us that sort of the relationship between those two, the physical simplicity of the brain versus its rich complexity in terms of how it functions, the trying to sort that matter out, in a sense, is the heart and soul of neuroscience. Explain to our listeners what you are spelling out here in terms of the complexity versus the simplicity of the human brain.
Sure. Well, if you picked up a human brain, it would it weighs pounds. It'd be comprised mostly of sort of, well, fat, basically. It's a 3-pound lump of fat. There aren't any bones in it. There's nothing. There's some calcification here and there, but it's not a particularly solid organ at all. So that's the gross anatomy, the grossest of anatomy. But within that, there are 83 billion neurons, tiny nerve cells, these sort of branched cells that have a cell body, which people might understand. But unlike other cells in the body, there are dozens of little branches, and they all connect to their neighbors. So when you've got 83 billion of them, and they can all make dozens of connections to their neighbors, some suggest that one neuron can make 1,000 connections with its neighbors. So when you do the maths on that, you get to a staggeringly large number of connections within the brain. In the trillion.
Right.
So that makes the brain the most complicated, the most complex system that has ever been discovered.
Can you say a word to our listeners about something that you mentioned right after the introduction, which is called the Human Connectome Project? I had not heard of this, but it sounds like an amazing undertaking. Explain to our listeners what this is about.
Well, it's the wiring diagram. It's an attempt to... the brain is organized in layers. And so when you're looking at the outside, you're seeing the neocortex, which is a relatively thin layer of cells that's covering the brain. They're folded in on themselves to increase the surface. And if you could unfold that surface layer, it would cover a couple of tennis courts. That sort of area. But and all those all those cells within that surface are all sort of wired in the lower regions of the rest of the brain that's hidden underneath. And so the Human Connectome Project is similar to the Human Genome Project. It's trying to create a program for the human brain. So how all of these different sections of the brain wire together. It's the electrical wiring that we're talking about here. So the branch cells, the neurons that we were talking about, they communicate through pulses of electricity. So along branches that are connecting to their neighbors, you've got pulses of electricity which then make a chemical leap from one cell to the next. Hmm. It's been understood for about 100 years or so, 100 years or so, that process. They aren't like switches. They don't just turn on and off. It's not just firing one message, like zapping the next-door neighbor. It's sending pulses, and the pulses of the pattern of those pulses varies. A cell within a branch of each cell. So the code that the brain is using is incredibly complicated, far beyond the sort of thing that a computer would do. But they also believe that there may be glial. As well as neurons, there are other cells, glial cells, within the brain, and they used to be thought to be sort of support cells for the electrical neuron network. It's possible. There's a growing school of thought that maybe there is a chemical network that's running through the glial cells as well. So if you've got 83 billion neurons, add in a similar number of glial cells, and you've just, you've doubled. I can't even do the maths. perhaps you've doubled your connections. Perhaps your number gone from the trillions into the quadrillions. Mm. So the human connectome is trying to create the electrical map. Whether that's enough, to understand, as I said before, to create the link between the mental and the physical, whether that is the breakthrough we need, we won't know until it's finished. It's been going for 5-6 years, who knows how long it's going to take.
Right. We're speaking with Tom Jackson about his book, The Brain, an illustrated history of neuroscience, part of a series called Ponderables, 100 Discoveries That Changed History, Who Did What When. His fascinating book, richly illustrated, by the way, is a history of neuroscience, of how human beings have struggled to understand the importance of the brain and its function. Mr. Jackson, one of the things that was especially intriguing to me as an American reading your book is how the history of neuroscience is not a straight line that sweeps out of the heart of Europe, for instance, but that there are other places on Earth where important breakthroughs were made, sometimes ancient breakthroughs were made, in places like Egypt and China and Iraq and other places around the globe that we might not immediately think of as places where what we think of now as scientific discoveries might be made. Were you surprised at just how, in a sense, how far-reaching this history would be?
I kind of knew that the Egyptians much of the brain already. It's perhaps common knowledge that when your pharaohs and your Egyptian nobility were mummified for the afterlife, the brain was, while a lot of the organs were very carefully handled in order to remain intact for the next journey, the brain literally just scraped out through a hole made in the top of the nose and just thrown away. The Egyptians thought that the brain did nothing more than shed excess heat from the body. It was like a radiator, so the blood coming up from the body was sent through the many. The Egyptians could see that there was a lot of a huge blood supply. Coming into the brain, they obviously probably also saw that other animals had an even more intricate blood supply. Things like oxen and goats and things like that would have an even more intricate blood supply into their brains. And they assumed that was some kind of heat dispersal system. To them, everything was taking place in the heart, and we still, even today, you know, when we talk from the heart, or my heart tells me this, or I have a broken heart, that sort of language comes from ancient Egypt. That those sorts of decisions and those sorts of attitudes that we're referring to when we use that terminology, we still place that in the heart, and that's the, you know, the Egyptian happening in there, which is an interesting idea. Did, you know, when an Egyptian was thinking to themselves, was their voice in the middle of their body? You know, the interior monologue, were they talking from downstairs, you know, from down in the center of the body? Obviously we'll never know. I mean, I don't know about you, but mine, when I think, it happens in my head.
Right, exactly. And we sort of know that it's up there in the head. Absolutely. Another sort of, in a sense, unexpected complexity in this history, as I read your book, although in retrospect, I should have anticipated it, but going into it, I just sort of assumed that this would be a book almost entirely exclusively about thinking and feeling and memory. And it didn't really dawn on me until I started reading that this history would also involve developing an understanding of things like our sense of smell or our eyesight or our hearing. Those are also, of course, incredibly intricate human functions in and of themselves, and all of them obviously directly impacted by and involving the brain. And when you stir that into the mix, it's no wonder that this becomes as complex a history as it is.
Sure, yeah. So the brain is the central nervous system along with the spinal cord. Central is the operative word. There's a peripheral nervous system which is spreads out from the central nervous system, which gives us interface with, you know, the rest of the world, with our surroundings, and the senses, the five senses. If you count touch as a single sense, then, you know, really it's a couple of dozen different senses working together. Really, the way that you can feel different sensations and heat and cold and all those things, we just lump them all together as touch. But really, there's a great deal going on in your skin. Many different detectors working together to create, to position your body, to tell you where your how your body is, its posture. And that really does work into your sense of self, ideas around things like night terrors, when people wake up and feel there's a presence in the room. That might be linked to your sensory, part of your sensory system being in a disjunction, in not fully connected to another part. For example, your muscles send, the position of your muscles send information to your brain, and if that's connected to what your skin is saying, for, you know, to simplify greatly, then you basically create two senses of self, two positions that your body's in. And if you wake up from a deep sleep and that has occurred and you haven't quite organized, you haven't and you haven't really fully woken up yet, then you can feel a presence near to you. So you're sort of your body, you're aware of your body as where it is, but there's also, you're aware of another presence, which is just the other part of your sensory system not quite getting tuned in yet.
Right.
The senses have very special connections with the brain, whereas a lot of the nerves, the peripheral nervous system, is coming out from your spinal cord and spreading out around your body. Your eyes and your ears and your tongue, they have sort of highways straight into the brain. They don't go via the... they've got a sort of privileged access to the brain.
Hmm.
And then, of course, what happens when that information arrives in the brain? That was a way in for early neurologists and neuroscientists to... learn how the brain works. Different ways people became blind, became deaf, lost the power of speech, lost the power of smell and taste. That gave them the opportunity to see the brain was injured, wasn't functioning properly, and that how they began to build up this functional map of what different bits of the brain, or an attempt to build up a functional map. There is this drive for us to be able to point at, for us to want to point at a bit of the brain and say that bit does this, when really, and a lot of the history of neuroscience is about building that functional map. But really, as we get more and more into understanding which bits of the brain do what, we find that basically it's all doing at the same time. There's associations between all different parts of the brain, which remarkably complicated, and people on a much higher pay grade than I are the ones who are figuring it out.
Or trying to.
Yeah.
I want to say, among the especially fascinating portions of the book is a chapter right in the middle called Neuroscience and Racism, in which you point out the way in which racism, sometimes overtly and sometimes in other ways that are not quite so overt, have at certain points in time really guided the thinking of neuroscientists and very much played a role in the assumptions that they made about various races and the people that populate them. It's kind of a disconcerting a part of the book, but an important part of the history for us to understand. Any comment in a minute or so?
Well, I think it stems from the fact that people who, the first neuroscientists, the first neurologists, were interested in the brain because they were interested in the thing that gave, that created humanity, that made we as an animal human. And they also were founding figures in anthropology, which is the study of humanity, and being middle 19th century men, as a lot of middle 19th century men did, that they were from Europe, that they were the cleverest people around, and therefore everyone else that they were beginning to hear about, and explorers were bringing back information from all over the rest of the world. The assumption was that these people who hadn't developed technology, there must be some difference in the brain. And so it all stems from there. It's all complete nonsense. There's a very long history of scientific data being ignored, being falsified to say that white men were cleverer than white women and cleverer than black men and women. So but that idea still endures, even though it's never been proven. It wasn't proven then. It's been debunked many times since. It still endures, doesn't it? It's something that we'll have to be taught to ignore for a long time to come.
Right. I want to mention that the book, once you have taken us through this history, which takes us right up to the era of computer brains and so on, takes us then through a series of very intriguing questions, which you call the imponderables. The points like being right-handed and left-handed, what is the nature of memory, why do we dream, how do we learn to talk, and so on. And then another very interesting appendix with a list of the great neuroscientists, when they lived, where they lived, and their contributions to this rich history. It's a beautifully crafted book, which also includes a wonderful timeline history that sort of folds out like a poster. And it's just one more way to further grasp this complex history, which you've laid out so wonderfully. The book is The Brain, An Illustrated History of Neuroscience, published by Shelter Harbor Press. Tom Jackson, congratulations on a superbly crafted book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you very much indeed.
It's 8:37, and you're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's part two of today's program. I like nothing more than to be introduced to an important person about whom I've never heard a word, and that's really the case with the New York Times bestseller, Dr. Mütter's Marvels, which introduces us to the very important figure of Thomas Dent Mütter, a very important doctor and surgeon from the 19th century, who, as much as anyone, helped to revolutionize the way that medicine was practiced, and especially the way in which surgery was practiced. And he was a gifted and in some ways incredibly flamboyant man, and he had a wonderful way with words. And so what he said about the profession of medicine is absolutely captivating, as is this book about him, Dr. Mütter's Marvels, A True Tale of Intrigue and Innovation at the Dawn of Modern Medicine, written by the award-winning author Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz. And she is born and raised in Philadelphia, where much of the story of Dr. Thomas Dent Mütter unfolds. And he is still very well known in the city of Philadelphia, not as well known as he should be, given his importance. And so I am so happy to have had the opportunity to read this endlessly fascinating book. And now I have a few precious minutes to speak with the author, Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, about this book published by Avery, an imprint of Penguin Random House. Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really happy to be here.
And I'm happy to be talking to someone who lives in Philadelphia, where I happen to have a brother who lives. And was I overstating it when I said that the city of Philadelphia well knows the name of Thomas Dent Mütter better than the rest of us do?
Absolutely. It is the home of the Mütter Museum, which is a museum of 19th century medical oddities. And so if you grew up in Philly, this was a place you went to a lot on field trips and school trips. and it just became a part of the culture of being a kid and growing up in Philly. And it wasn't until I left Philly that I realized there was anything unusual about it, and that not every kid grows up with a medical oddity science museum in their childhood. And that's how I first became interested in learning more about the man who founded it.
Absolutely.
Of which little was known.
And I want us to talk about that. I want to give you maybe 40 seconds to just list a couple of the really interesting things that are found at that museum. I mean, I think it's important for people to appreciate that.
Absolutely. Well, there's Madame Dimanche. She's a woman who had a horn that started growing from the center of her forehead. She's actually from Dr. Mutter's original collection. We have the death cast and conjoined liver of Chang and Ang, the famous sideshow act, the conjoined twins, which gave us the term Siamese twins. They have a 9-foot megacolon that was extracted from a human being who is known as the human balloon. The megacolon is so popular that they actually sell a plushy version of the megacolon in their gift store, so you could take it home with you. You have the Hurdle Skull Collection, which is skulls collected from all over the world to disprove the concept of phrenology, the idea that you can tell people's character through ridges on their skulls. You have, limbs in jars. The thing I couldn't handle was the wall of eye trauma, essentially a wall of eyeballs of which awful things have all happened to them and how we would treat such a thing. It's a pretty, I wouldn't suggest, you know, I've had now 2 book release parties at the museum, and I always say I save a lot on catering because no one wants to eat after visiting the museum.
Right. Of course, the thing that's interesting is that museum, it brings his name to the public, but in a sense it doesn't necessarily help us understand just how important he was and what a revolutionary figure he was. Explain how the state of medicine was in such a state that Dr. Mutter found it so deeply objectionable. I think most of us don't know enough about early medicine before it really began to enjoy scientific rigor.
Exactly. I mean, even the tools. I mean, that's one of the things I must have thought was so frustrating, is to have an innate instinct towards things like germ theory, right? The idea that diseases can be and infections can be spread through, contact with an infected surface, whether that's a hand or a tool. That was not proven, really, until the invention of the modern microscope in the late 1800s. Mutter died in 1859. So he, his belief that you should wash your hands and tools prior to surgery was seen as a feat and weak. One of his colleagues at the university he taught at, Miggs, used to be offended at the idea that doctors would wash their hands prior to seeing patients because, quote, it insisted that doctors were not gentlemen because all gentlemen were clean men. So the idea that doctors were actually taking stances against washing your hands and tools gives you a clue of what 19th century was like. They didn't have electric lighting, so all surgeries were done by candlelight or sunlight. They didn't have ether anesthesia. All surgery patients were awake during their procedures, and in fact, a part of the service was men would be paid to hold you down on the surgical table, both to keep you still during the surgery, but also to prevent you from running away. You did not need a license to practice medicine. You did not need a degree to practice medicine. You literally could just say you were a doctor, hang a shingle outside of your house, and begin putting leeches on people. It was a real wild, wild west. And during Mutter's lifetime, the changes that made for what we know and enjoy as modern medicine today began to fall into place. And Mutter himself was at the forefront of it. You know, he really viewed medicine and practiced medicine in a way that I think today we would all love to be treated. And this was, decades before some of his theories would be proven. So he was really forward thinking and, a great hero in my mind.
You connect him to the city of Paris, France in several different ways.
Yes.
How important was that in terms of shaping the kind of doctor that he was? I mean, living and working in Paris, was that an important contributing factor in the groundbreaking work which he did?
Absolutely. You know, back in the 19th century, you know, if you were going to study medicine, you could not really be an exceptional doctor, you know, one who worked in the highest stratas, unless you were already born into a wealthy class, because wealthy people would only trust, you know, other wealthy people at that time period. You wouldn't take someone whose background you didn't know to examine your wife. You know, that was just seen as completely implausible. The only field in which you could really come from the background that Mutter was a poor orphan, and succeed and make a name for yourself was surgery, because it was something where skill would outweigh any other factor. You know, if you were going to have your leg cut off and you were awake during the surgery, you kind of didn't care if that guy knew your dad. You know, what you cared about was, would it be done cleanly, as with as least pain as possible, and would you survive the surgery? In order to be the best surgeon possible, Mutter, you know, kind of tricked his way over to Paris to study with the best surgery being done in the world at that time period, and came across the field of study which he would become known for, which over there was called operations plastique, and what today we would know as plastic surgery or reconstructive surgery. And this was an area of surgery that was brand new to modern medicine. Obviously, if you were having surgeries done on you while you were awake, you would only want that to happen if it was a life or death situation, essentially elective surgery, right? Wanting to help fix a deformity or disfigurement by choice was not something a lot of people made, unless they were certain that that the outcome would make their life better and happier, and that they would survive the surgery. And Mutter saw plastic surgery for the first time in Paris and knew immediately that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to come back to America and reach out to these populations of patients that were completely underserved. I mean, the severely deformed back then were literally categorized medically as monsters. That was a medical term, in the way that idiot was a medical term. And he saw these people as human beings. You know, he was very sick throughout his entire life, and especially through his childhood, and he knew what it was like to be a patient and knew what it was like to not be treated well by the doctors who were tasked with healing you. And he knew that this was a population that did not get the respect it deserved.
Right.
So he went in back to America and did revolutionary work. The surgeries that he did and invented were so forward-thinking that there's some of them are still being used today.
We should mention that early in his life, he actually received some very good care from physicians. I think it was something where they were at sort of spelling out very clearly what his future was likely to be physically, and he so appreciated the care he received that that's one of the things that inspired him to pursue a medical profession.
Absolutely. That sort of clarity and transparency was not a part of 19th century medicine. People rarely sought the help of doctors and only in extreme situations. And doctors, you know, again, if you're performing work on a patient without any sort of painkiller or anesthetic, it's going to be excruciating for that person. And you're just going to have to ignore their screams and cries to get the work done that you know needs to be done. So there was a big gulf between patient and doctor. And doctors were sort of trained to sort of ignore their patients. And Mutter just took a stride against it. And you could see that in the work that he did. I mean, one of the things that is, I think, most apparent metaphor is he was the inventor of what we know to be the modern recovery room. You know, prior to that, if you had surgeries done in a surgical clinic, they just put you in sort of an unwashed wagon and rode you home over the cobblestone streets of Philadelphia. Mutter was appalled by this. You know, he was doing these very delicate surgeries, and he didn't want infection to set in. He didn't want the stitches to be disrupted by rattling in a wagon, and he insisted that the college that he taught at, Jefferson Medical College, build recovery rooms, and they refused. They just did not see the reason for it, and Mutter was so adamant that this be done that he himself used his own money to rent a floor above a restaurant and would move his patients into that floor and watch over them along with the help of his students. Today, that seems like common sense. Of course you would do that, but back then it was just unheard of. So that's an example of the humanist philosophies that Mutter put into practice that really put the patient and the patient's care front and center, instead of the infallible, you know, dictations of the doctor, which was definitely the way 19th century medicine, you know, moved.
It's especially fascinating in your book to read about the battle over anesthesia and the fact that and Dr. Mutter did not invent anesthesia, but he was one of its most persuasive champions. And your book outlines the reservations that most other doctors had about anesthesia, in particular the fact that some doctors relied on the what the patient would tell them through the course of the surgery, and the idea that of the patient being out cold during the surgery. How are we going to talk to them then? but for other reasons too, some of them just could not open themselves up to this notion.
And
it's fascinating to read of Dr. Mutter's tenacious insistence that this was the only humane way to do surgery.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty shocking, you know. In researching Dr. Mutter's marvels, you know, I'd always thought that scientific progress was sort of, you know, a march up a mountain, you know, innovation building upon innovation. And when you would have something like, ether anesthesia surgery being, you know, essentially invented, that doctors would flock to it. Oh, my God, this is clearly the next thing. To realize that there was a battle against it, that hospitals banned it, was shocking to me. But again, when you view it through the lens of the 19th century, it began to make more sense. You know, one of the reasons you spoke about was that doctors throughout time had performed surgeries on and learned from their patients who were awake during the surgeries. So if you were talking to a patient and he began to sort of fade away and you realize, oh, this patient is at risk of bleeding out, and if I don't stop the surgery now, they're going to die on my table. If the patient is already unconscious, how would you ever get that information before you had the medical tools that we have today? Another reason was because of the lack of standardized medicine. You know, it's another thing I always took for granted of. I don't expect the Tylenol I buy in New York City to be different than the Tylenol I buy in Chicago. But back then, you know, your jar of ether could have varying strength depending on who made it or where it was made or when it was made. So the surgeries themselves were with a very unstable chemical. And the last one was sort of the most surprising to me, which was before germ theory was really proven, doctors did not wash their hands and tools, and the death rates of people who had surgery under ether versus surgery while they were awake were pretty much exactly the same, which is shocking. You would think that a thrashing person on the table would cause a lot more deaths than someone who was calmly knocked out. But it was the infections after the surgeries that were the real killers of 19th century medicine.
And it didn't matter how the surgery was done, in a sense. I mean,
right. Exactly. And so it was really the doctor's choice. If the doctor says, you know, it doesn't seem to affect their death rates, they die at the same rate, whether or not they're knocked out enough, and I don't trust this chemical, and I've done surgeries with people awake the whole time, it's my choice whether or not I want to do this. Then it kind of makes sense. But of course, as a patient, you would think you would choose to be knocked out every time. Unfortunately, at that time in medicine, we were not given the option of whether or not we would want that service. But, you know, those sorts of things just made researching Dr. Mutter's marvels such a pleasure. You know, I really, you know, fell in love with that time period and the debates and the, you know, discoveries that were happening. Everything was so new, and you have people like Mutter who had a vision. You know, Mutter was fastidiously clean. He knew innately, and perhaps from being a patient himself, the difference between a clean doctor and a dirty doctor, and knew that being clean, fastidiously so, is going to help your patient in the long run. But his theories on this wouldn't be proven for 50 years after his death. You know, it's incredible what he was forced to endure for things that would later be, you know, proven with a microscope or proven with an X-ray.
A man truly ahead of his time who made life better for so many people.
Yes.
And your book tells the story so brilliantly. The book, again, is Dr. Mutter's Marvels, a New York Times bestseller now, available in paperback. Kristen O'Keefe Aptewitz, its author. Kristen O'Keefe Aptewitz, congratulations on an absolutely spectacular book. I loved every page. And thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
coming up Monday on the morning show, you're going to be hearing my interview with Gerard Coppel. He is a historian with whom I spoke not long ago about his previous book called Bond of Union, in which he tells the amazing story of the design of and construction of the Erie Canal, which utterly transformed early America. His latest book is called City on a Grid: How New York Became New York. In this book, Gerard Coppel examines the grid which encapsulates most of Manhattan, the heart of New York City, a very rigid grid of streets and avenues, the vast majority of which are numbered, and in very stark rectangular shape. And he wondered at one point, he lives in New York, wondered, where did that come from, that specific rigid design, which, of course, was imitated by other American cities, in contrast to other cities in which one found circles and diagonals and ovals and stars and all kinds of other shapes, many of which, in a sense, can make life a little more hospitable for human beings. But someone decided that this rigid grid should be the way that New York City was laid out. And indeed, that rigid grid did seem to pay off in certain exciting ways. And in other ways, it also made the city, in some respects, a bit more inhumane and inhospitable. Gerard Coppel examines this history in his fascinating new book, and we talk about it on Monday's morning show. On Tuesday, we're going to be looking back 100 years to the Turkish genocide against Armenian Christians. There's going to be a special event and concert coming up on Tuesday, the 24th of November. On Tuesday, the 17th, I look forward to having several guests in my on my program to talk about this event and the importance of commemorating it, including Yepen Kalijian, who is priest at St. Mesrob Armenian Apostolic Church in Racine, Susan Proctor, who is president of the congregation. And we'll talk to a couple of different musicians who are going to be participating in this special memorial program, including Nick Perudian, who heads up the Bell Ensemble, a brand new and wonderful music ensemble in Racine. We're also going to be hearing next week from author William Doyle in its entirety, the interview I recorded with him about his new book about John F. Kennedy and the sinking of the PT-109, an event which really helped shape who John F. Kennedy ultimately would become. Next week, we're also hoping to have an interview about the controversy surrounding coal and its potential devastating health effects on people here in southeastern Wisconsin. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The Morning Show is archived at our website, WGTD.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. Information at carthage.edu/grad. Partly sunny and once again a very, very windy day. Wind gusts up to 45 miles per hour today, a high of just 43. Clear and breezy and cold tonight, a low of 28 degrees. Tomorrow should be sunny with a high of 53 degrees. And actually Sunday, sunny, and we should warm to close to 60 degrees. A 40% chance of rain, however, on Monday. Rain expected also Tuesday and Wednesday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.